So there you go. That was awfully unsporting of us, wasn't it?
Yeah, really. Very kind to juxtapose the Pete Best Decca version of Money with the studio version that most people are familiar with.
Yeah, recorded almost 2 years later with the Beatles, not nervous, not hungover, and in top form by that time.
Yeah,
so had happened.
The purpose here is this show is going to be really about the drumming with the Beatles. You know, Ringo, Pete Best, making comparisons.
Yeah, compare contrast in our own cruel way. And it's not, you know, I mean, there was this myth that went on forever that Pete was kicked out of the group because he was too good looking and too popular.
Right, and the Beatles were jealous of him.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Yeah, and you see how his fan base followed him when he was in the next band after the Beatles.
Yeah.
But no, seriously, you know, Ringo gets this bad rap through the years that he was just this lucky little cipher that, you know, happened to be asked into the most successful act of the 60s just on the eve of their success, as if his coming into the band had nothing to do with it, and it could have been anybody.
Right, and you know, the truth of it is that, you know, A, Ringo really gelled with the Beatles personality-wise, which Pete Best never did.
Right.
He was a complete loner, and he really undermined himself by separating himself from the group most of the time in sort of social settings.
Sure, I mean, if he could have known the future, maybe he would have acted differently. But, you know, this is not to beat up Pete Best at all. He's
right.
A nice guy.
Right. And the other side is, you know, the drumming ability. And there's no doubt about it. Ringo was, you know, one of the top people in Liverpool at that time.
Creative, imaginative. And the thing that's amazing is the Beatles couldn't have known this before they asked him into the band. Mm. I mean, they'd played with him a handful of times, enough to where, you know, George was quoted as like, you know, that the way that ensemble felt when Ringo was behind the kit, this is it, this is what it's all about, this just feels good.
Yeah.
But what they couldn't have known is just how intuitive he was in the studio and knowing how to recalibrate his approach to playing drums to fit the demands of the song. You know, all they'd ever played was club dates, except for the odd recording session here and there without Ringo. They did the one in Hamburg, which no one has heard, you know, the summertime session with Wally. But Ringo, in so many levels, not only was a great live drummer, as you say, the best in Liverpool, fantastic studio drummer once he got past that false start with Love Me Do, and so influential on every drummer that came after him in the 60s, and there's no taking away from that. And that's just one part of the package. You've got the personality, you've got the wit, you've got the charm, you know, you've got all that star power, no pun intended. You know, plenty of people drummed well on 60s British rock records, yet he was one more piece of the puzzle where these Beatles projected themselves as personalities that transcended making good records.
Yeah.
Lots of people made good records, but, you know, what do you know about the other guys in Herman's Hermits?
Right, absolutely. I mean, the thing about Ringo is that he wasn't, you know, Keith Moon. He wasn't a technical drummer, and he didn't dominate with his sound. He basically gave the Beatles what they needed, you know, and he's understated in his drumming.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean, you know, he's not contributing what they need. It's actually the opposite of that.
Yes.
And as I mentioned in the previous episode, that, you know, George Martin said that Ringo's sound is all of his own. The way he tuned the kit was, you know, unique. And he was also creative in those days, you know, his use of toms and various other percussion instruments.
He kept up past the live era of them just being a simple beat group going out there, and as sophisticated as their music was, you know, basically in a live situation, all he had to do was keep the beat, keep that wash of hi-hat going and, you know, pound the kick and the snare and flog the cymbals. And, you know, not a lot was demanded of him other than just driving that band, which is huge. But where the real creativity came in is what he did in the studio, especially when they segued into the studio years and they were, you know, setting out to rewrite the rule book of rock and roll.
Yeah, I think around sort of 65, actually, you know, that's a kind of a sort of era where there is that, the crossover's beginning, you know, the beat groups are going to start fading and some of the serious, the heavies come onto the scene, right? You know, whether it's the Yardbirds or, you know, those kinds of bands.
Sure.
And Ringo moves with that. I mean, you know, something like Ticket to Ride, for instance. I don't think that's your straightforward drumming there.
No, it's not. He could have done the straight beat he'd done and everything else. And apparently Paul was one that gave him the direction and input on that.
Right.
But, you know, that was what he did. And I think you see throughout the next year, 66, that's where he really starts to get bold and adventurous. You know, the stuff he did on Rain, which he often cites as one of his favorite performances. You know, they end 1966 doing Strawberry Fields and then into the Pepper era. You know, considering he was playing that same limited Ludwig kit, the fact that he was able to get those amazing sounds, you know, what he was doing in 66, 67 sounded nothing like what he was doing 63, 64.
Yeah.
It just so well speaks of his imagination.
Yeah. Now, you know, going back to what we just heard with the Decca audition, again, we have to be fair about this. The Beatles don't sound good themselves. You know, none of them do particularly.
They don't.
They're all holding back. They all sound nervous. George sounds the most confident.
Well, you know, yes. And that is true. He sounds amazing. Mm. I mean, John, of all people, you know, you hear him singing Money, he sounds nervous. Song he'd sung hundreds of times on stage.
Absolutely.
He starts to hit his stride by the time he does Hello Little Girl, his original tune. He starts to sound like John Lennon more.
Yeah.
But, all right, just to get them in more of an optimum performance mode with Pete Best. Let's go to 1961, the Tony Sheridan sessions, and hear a little bit of My Bonnie.
Well, but, yeah, and let's point something out here. And
we have a story.
We have, a great story, and it's thanks to Mark Lewison in the book Tune In. And, you know, speaking to the audio engineer who worked on the session with Burt Kempfert as the producer, and he said that there was no coordination between hand and foot with Pete. Mm. And, in fact, we got Tony Sheridan himself in the book saying that he really didn't rate him. I'm being kind here.
Yes.
He puts it in harsher words, but that he really didn't rate Pete as a drummer at all. And the amazing thing, never heard this before. So anyone out there hasn't heard this before, get ready. You're never going to hear this record the same way again.
Yeah, read the book.
Yeah, but basically they removed the bass pedal because it was a mess. The timing was completely out. So what you actually hear now is that there is no bass pedal on this track, and John, with his rhythm guitar, has to make up for that, basically, to help Paul, basically, to lock in with Paul.
Right, to keep that rhythm going.
Yeah.
Now, I will tell you straight up that unless you have the unadulterated original mix of My Bonnie from 1962, the single, that is really where you're hearing the pure performance, such as it is, minus the kick drum. But we do know that later on, when the Beatles started to become famous and those Hamburg recordings with Tony Sheridan were dusted off for wide release, there was some overdubbing done over Pete's drumming. And that's most of what you find in circulation now. I was, for this show, trying to find a nice mono recording, and all I could dig up on short notice was stereo mixes. Mm. So I can't tell you if this is just Pete or if it's Bernard Purdy on top of him, but you know, let's just listen anyway and get an idea of what was the basis of their drumming in 1961.
My bonnet lies over the ocean. My thank you.
tell there, but you get the drift.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of Pete Best, and also just his penchant for those 16th note drum fills.
Right.
That he throws into everything.
Right.
Again, I'm not here to bury Pete Best, or maybe I am, but it is what it is.
Well, yeah, and something, again, I don't want to take credit for. This was a discussion with Mark Lewisohn some time ago, because I've always, you know, been of the opinion that the way that the Beatles got rid of Pete was pretty shoddy.
Which we know now, per Mark Lewisohn, was also a pattern.
A pattern, that's right. If you read the book, you'll see that they did that someone else earlier on with the Quarrymen, exactly the same kind of approach. Get someone else to do the dirty work.
Yes.
But I sort of said, you know, and then I was going on about how terrible it was that right on the cusp of fame, mm-hmm. Pete misses out. And Mark said to me, well, I don't think you're getting it. You know, the fact of it is, Pete Best was actually, given his lack of drumming ability, he was actually remarkably lucky to have had 18 months with the Beatles. And he's been able to ride that wave ever since.
Yes, he has. Yeah. You know, there's the years in the wilderness, but you know, he became a millionaire off Anthology.
So it's not so much that he was terribly unlucky. He was actually really lucky because most people of that ability or non-ability wouldn't have been with the Beatles.
And honestly, who among us thinks that if they'd kept him in the group, they would have scaled the heights they did?
Absolutely. I mean, he would have been okay in terms of the mean, moody look, you know, and all of that stuff. But in the studio, they would have had to bring in another drummer.
They would have.
Yeah.
And even if he, you know, I mean, there's all this talk about, you know, well, I was just as good a drummer as Ringo, which we know is nonsense to anybody with ears. In fact, we'll hear something in a minute that underscores that beautifully. But even if he didn't have the personality, which he clearly didn't, even if he had the skill set, you know, would the Beatles have been as successful as they were? I don't think so.
No, absolutely
not. Because of the personality that they projected and wit and all these other non-musical aspects.
Right.
And he just wasn't a contributor to that.
No, not at all.
Which is not to beat him up. You know, you are what you are.
Well, let's beat him up. You know, who cares? But I mean, you know, Pete Best in A Hard Day's Night, Pete Best in Help. You know,
yes.
I mean, where do you go with all this, you know?
They wouldn't have been comedies.
No.
They would have been dramas.
Yeah. So we move on to...
Yeah, so, well, here's the perfect illustration. You know, the June 62 EMI session that, you know, for years everybody thought was a tryout or a test recording. No, in fact, it was the recording session for what would have been their first single had something adequate resulted from it. And what they took a stab at, we know they did Besame Mucho. They also did Love Me Do.
Yeah, and I, you know, we should say up front as well, again, I don't know who was responsible for the arrangement, but I would guess it was John and Paul who came up with, you know, with the tempo change in the middle eight on this version.
Well, you think so?
Well, who do you think? I mean, do you think
Pete was maybe on his own trying to get creative, or maybe that was what he was used to doing in a live situation.
Yeah,
Because, yes, it goes into the shuffle midway through the song. You know,
And they all sound
lost. Random.
Yeah, exactly. It's completely random, and they sound totally lost, and so does he.
And that's what you do in a live situation. You recalibrate, you know, you read what's going on with the crowd, and you might do something different that you wouldn't do in the studio, and that's kind of what he does here. And I'm sure, you know, most people listening to this have heard Anthology 1, but if you haven't heard it lately, take a listen to this, and you'll see why Pete Best had to go.
So please love me do.
It really is, actually, because in a way, you know, whether the decision had been taken or not at that point to boot him out of the band, it's like what we're hearing is the final nail in his coffin.
Yes.
I mean, you know, that must have been when George Martin heard that. That's mm-hmm. when he must have thought session drummer next time.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And he did give Ringo his chance, and that was inadequate. And, you know, I'm not going to speak to what Ringo's shortcomings were on that September 4th take. I mean, it sounds okay. To me, it doesn't sound as strong and robust as the Andy White one, but Ringo from that point on was fine. And it was really, I thought, listening to the single version of Love Me Do that emerged, I thought Paul came off the worst.
Yeah.
And he sounds so nervous. His voice is shaky.
And he says he was nervous, doesn't he? He says you can hear it. The red light went on.
Yeah.
And it was record, and he got nervous.
And you would think by that time he was a bit of an old hand at
recording.
Well,
but look at the Royal Variety performance, you know, and when he does Till There Was You.
Mm.
And you can see, if you watch the film of that, you can see the nerves.
It's funny because that pattern goes back to the Quarrymen days, and you know, he thought he was going to be the lead guitarist, and he completely flubbed that, paving the way for George's entry into the Quarrymen.
Interesting, isn't it? That, really, you sort of think of McCartney as being a pretty confident guy.
Right.
But yeah.
I mean, it's something he really developed and nurtured, I guess, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So you're in for a treat. We are going to lay on you a nice little what-if scenario. Assuming that Pete's non-engaging, charming, bubbly personality was not a factor in keeping him around. And let's assume that they were able to look past his shortcomings as a drummer and carry on with him. And let's assume that the Beatles then proceeded to put out the same body of work they would have, and that the world accepted it, and that the Beatles accepted it, and everybody saw past it, and it was fine. You know, here, by the time 1969 comes around, they're recording their last musical statement as a band. And there is old Pete behind the kit. You know, maybe he's grown his hair a little longer by this time. I'm not sure.
and Pete, one second. So Pete's gone through sort of Revolver. You know, he's drummed on Tomorrow Never Knows. And he's and what's he like, provided the good old shuffle beat to Tomorrow Never Knows?
whatever, you know, his array of skills from A to B. It's all there. So
that's right. He runs the gamut of skills from A to B.
Yes. So let's imagine, let's close our eyes and just listen, listeners, for a moment. The Beatles, 1969, with Pete Best behind the kit.
Well, but there's some bass pedal in there.
Yeah, well, he'd gotten sophisticated.
He evolved.
In the 7 years.
Right, right. But the whole notion that they would have accepted that, you know, what he's doing to Lennon's composition.
Yes. Oh, where do you hear A Day in the Life?
That is absolutely brilliant.
Yep.
Absolutely brilliant. I love the breaks.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Well, the master of the 16th note drum fill.
Who did this?
I don't know.
All right.
Some genius. Yeah.
Was this off YouTube?
Yes, it was.
I'm like, are there a whole series of these?
There's like four of them. And one of them is A Day in the Life.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is
Here Comes the Sun's on there too, I believe. We love you, Pete.
Yeah, really.
Nothing personal.
Yeah, that's right.
So, on the subject of Tony Sheridan's judgment of Pete Best's skills, as you said, crap drummer,
yeah.
But he went on to describe it being bigger than his skills, because he was being questioned backstage after a show, and they're talking about Pete Best and Hamburg and all that sort of thing, and really centering on why Pete Best didn't work out, and he goes on to say that, yes, Pete didn't quite have the skill set. And if you read Lewison's book, he's very explicit about how it would really anger him how terrible he was.
He had no coordination between hands and foot.
Yeah, there's that. And I think the bigger thing is, because if you've got the basics, given the hours they were working, I mean, clearly he didn't have the imagination of a lot of drummers and
right.
that creativity, but you're going to get at least incrementally better, and he might have been able to save himself, at least drum skill set wise, if he'd worked at it a little bit more.
Well, I think, you know, and they might have fought for him a bit more, wanted him more, had he fit in personality wise. That was the absolute killer.
And that's exactly what Tony Sheridan alludes to here,
yeah.
is that he was the loner. He wasn't creative or artsy like the other guys were. It just was a very bad fit.
Oh, and he never hung around. You know, whatever they were doing, he basically excluded himself time and again. You
yes.
know, if you look at the Astrid Kirscher shots, you know, at the
fairground,
the mm-hmm. Dom, you know, fairground, you see he's in that group shot, the famous group shot.
Yes.
But all the solo shots
right.
of them, he's not there because
right.
he'd already gone off somewhere.
With Stewart in the background out of focus. Yeah.
Right.
You
right.
see them of John and George and Paul.
Yeah.
But none of Pete.
None of Pete. And as Mark Lewison makes it clear in his book, that was like a repeating pattern. You know, it was
right.
all the time that they would be doing things and he wouldn't be with them. He'd go off on his own.
Mm-hmm.
In his autobiography, you know, he tries to give the impression that he was just one of the guys. And
yeah.
he and John rolled a sailor one night, you know, and it was, and the, I think he at one point refers to the good old team of Lennon and Best, or, you know, Best and Lennon or whatever. And it's mm-hmm. like, I think it's all disingenuous.
Oh, I think so too. I think that he truly didn't get it. And again, folks, we're not here to crucify Pete Best. It's here as sort of this historic exploration of why things didn't work out.
Yeah.
I do think it's pretty clear, you know, who had the better skill set. And also in this interview, Tony Sheridan says that, you know, because I don't know how many people know this, but that Tony, in between stints in the Hurricanes, actually was part of Tony Sheridan's band. Mm. Ringo was in Hamburg.
Yeah.
And Tony takes credit for working Ringo hard and elevating his game, such as it were, you know, and apparently he wouldn't do the same for Pete, but... You know, that aside, he says that it's a pity almost. He almost frames it as feeling sorry for Pete Best that it was within his power to make himself an enduring member of the Beatles. If he'd stepped up, raised his game as a drummer, and just tried to fit in more, and sort of lamenting, he goes and he calls him a martyr, you know, in terms of he was sacrificed himself ultimately for the greater good in paving the way inadvertently with his shortcomings and not raising his game for Ringo to become necessary.
You know, the famous atom beat.
Yes.
Was that a Woolerism? Who coined that?
It sounds like
a Woolerism.
It sounds like a Woolerism. It was certainly the talk associated with him. And this is the thing. You know, there are contrarians out there that will say, well, you know, Pete Best, they were perfectly fine star band in Liverpool and Hamburg with Pete Best. They were the most popular. They were getting all this attention. They couldn't quite take it to the next level without Brian Epstein's help. But that anybody could have been the drummer that succeeded Pete Best, and that Ringo was not necessary to where they ended up, which I think is just nonsense.
Right.
Because for the reasons we've described, you know, his star power, his
charisma. And, you know, I know, like, you know, George Martin said he would have been perfectly happy if they wanted Pete Best on the road in the studio to have a session drummer. But would the Beatles, as we know them, you know, John, George and Paul, have ever settled for that? I kind of doubt it.
No, I don't think so. They were always looking for the next best
thing. I mean, you know, had it been like Stu Sutcliffe, right, has stayed with the band, you get the feeling that Paul would have one way or the other edged him out. You know,
yeah, he would have usurped his role sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
Although, as a discussion of Stuart Sutcliffe, it would have been fantastic if he had not died.
Yeah.
Just being in the Beatles' tight orbit.
Yeah.
You know, what a gifted visionary he was artistically, what he could have done for their presentation.
And really, you know, it's amazing when you think back that he died really on the eve of their start, you know, April of 62.
Right.
So it's like, God, if he'd have just, you know,
a year later,
months,
look where
a year later, he would have seen it happen.
Yeah, he would have.
Yeah.
That's a real pity.
Yeah.
Yeah. So... I know there have been quotes of Tony Sheridan calling Pete Best the biggest loser in the world, but really that's out of context. He was sort of lamenting that he had this greatness almost within his grasp, and he just wasn't able to seize the brass ring.
Well, there's no doubt that had he really gelled with them personality-wise, then they most say wouldn't have wanted to get rid of him. They might have fought to, you know, keep him.
Yes,
but
they might have kept the loyalty. But, you know, once they caught wind of Ringo's ability and really bonded with him, as a personality, you know, it was hard to, you know, everything.
And they had been
short.
Bonding with him for some. George certainly had been as well. He was one who really pushed for Ringo.
And around the other drummers they worked with, that they are quite frank about the skill sets of, you know, Norman Chapman, Tommy Moore, you know, these people that they worked with pre-Pete Best that they said were fantastic drummers.
Yeah.
But it didn't satisfy them.
Right.
So you have to really recognize that for the Beatles' criteria of who should be occupying the drum seat, it was bigger than what they can do on the drums.
Right.
It was more, who do we get along with? Who's got the same vision as we do?
Well, because, of course, there was the big three drummer.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, Johnny Hutch.
Johnny Hutch.
Yeah.
And Hutch apparently hated them.
Yes, he did.
And he was, you know...
Quite vocal about it.
Yeah, really. Uh-huh. So that was never going to happen. And isn't there a story that they first were going after Johnny Hutch?
Yes, they asked him around the time they were asking Ringo.
Yeah.
And you know, he was like, if he had said the barge pole line about, you know, has so much disdain for the Beatles, he wanted nothing to do with them.
Right.
He was willing to sit in with them every
because,
now and again.
I mean, what's the consensus that you picked up on that Hutch was number one in Liverpool and Ringo was like number two? Or, you know,
it depends on who you're asking, but Johnny Hutch was never accused of having the star power.
No.
He was like a John
Have
Bonham,
you ever heard
if you will.
His drumming particularly?
Oh, sure. Yeah. We played that clip of What I'd Say.
Yes.
Annie Buick episode.
Yeah.
So yeah, you can hear what we can do. Although I'm sure that in optimum conditions and not recording at the Cavern, you probably could have heard really what he was capable of.
Right.
To me, it sounds a little bit flat.
Yeah.
But, you know, according to anybody who ever saw these bands live, they were a powerhouse.
Yes.
They were just like huge.
Yeah.
You know, it's like imagine Cream playing in a basement somewhere.
Right.
Yeah. You know, that's kind of the impression I get.
Yeah.
But did he have the charisma? No. You know, he was a heavy hitter and he was very skillful, but that wasn't what the Beatles needed.
But it is, it's, as George says in Anthology, it comes over as a bit disingenuous when he sort of says, you know, that really Ringo was always, you know, one of the Beatles. It just entered the story a bit later. But that's how I took it when I first heard it. I thought, well, that sounds like he's glossing over again. But I get it now, actually. I think he, what he says makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because not only his ability as a drummer and the style of drumming, which fit in with them, let's face it,
mm-hmm.
they didn't want a Keith Moon in that setup.
No,
right?
It would not have worked.
No. So, you know, he's the perfect drummer for them, and personality-wise, he absolutely gels with them.
He absolutely does, and despite the fact not having an education to speak of formally, he had the street sense.
Yeah.
And he did have his own artistic sensibility. This is a guy that knew how to dress.
Yes.
You know, he always had a great visual thing going on. You could see that throughout the Beatles' entire career.
Yeah.
You know, once they stop the uniform mindset of all dressing alike and he's doing his own thing, you know, he always had a sense of style.
And he was also okay ego-wise with them, right?
Yeah, you know, he knew his place.
Yeah, he knew his place. I mean, this is a, you know, he's a hard guy like the rest of them. Right?
Yes.
You know, they all kind of looked up to Ringo in a way as well, as a cool guy.
Yeah.
You know, maybe not as a musician, but I know as a cool guy.
Yeah, for sure.
So, you know, he fit in that way as well. And I think he really comes into his own. You see it happen in the Maisel's Brother film, you know, in February of 64.
Mm-hmm.
He's now in his element and he's kind of... When you look at him in interviews in 63, he's much more retiring, Ringo.
That's
you
true.
Know, if you watch like the Ken Dodd interview, you know, Morecambe Wise, well, he's shoved in the back anyway,
yeah,
kind
right.
of thing. But
still drawing the audience to him from the back of the stage.
Yes.
Just like there's some of that Saturday Club stuff. Where, you know, you hear him like off mic.
Yeah.
But he's still the one that you kind of gravitate toward because
kind of
he's,
interesting.
He's so funny.
It's interesting, though, the Morecambe Wise one, that he doesn't join in with them to be singing at the front of the stage. They could just have all four of them.
Right.
Right? But for some reason, he's stuck in the background there up on his drum riser.
But still sort of stealing the scene.
Well, it's all the bongo.
In, as much as you can, yeah. And if you look at the precedent for rock bands where you've got four guys that are all stars in their own right, it didn't really exist before the Beatles.
No.
I mean, it certainly wasn't true of the Shadows.
Although Ringo did have his own star time as part of, you know, Rory Storm and the Hurricanes.
Right, so it was recognized. You know,
yeah.
And that was one of the things John pointed out and Lennon remembers and maybe the Playboy interview, that whatever his talent was, it was apparent to everybody who knew him that there was something, he was meant for something bigger than being the guy at the back of the stage.
It's funny, isn't it? They stuck with that, the Beatles, as well, because you could have sort of said it was a bit more show busy that you have, you know, I mean, you'd never have Charlie Watts doing a turn, right?
Right.
You know, so it's kind of, you know, you'd think, well, the Stones got a bit more street cred there, that, you know, they don't have their drummer doing a turn.
Contrived show business.
And yet, all the way to the end, all the way to Abbey Road,
you've
got Ringo having his spot.
Look who the two most popular Beatles became in America.
Yeah.
You know, virtually sight unseen. It was Ringo and Paul. Paul's the pretty one, but Ringo has got that, whatever it is he projects, people were drawn to it.
Well, wasn't it feeling a bit sorry for him?
There was that, but then once he got on mic, you know, you heard him talk, and he's funny and droll and all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and not for no accident did they build their films around him.
Right.
You know,
right.
Except the unscripted one, Let It Be, which is a whole different thing.
I mean, you do sort of wonder, you know, all the mean and moody magnificence of Pete Best. But as we said, you know, if he was in one of the films, you sort of really wonder how he would have carried that. Because whenever I've seen him on camera, and again, it's not dissing the guy, but he just doesn't have that charisma.
No, he's kind of a potted plant.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to get out of him anything more than...
Don't mince your words.
people love potted plants. I love potted plants. I've known many potted plants. They wouldn't have popped the same way. I mean, certainly they couldn't have done A Hard Day's Night with Pete Best. It would have been a wholly different film.
Yeah.
You know, did you ever see the one Dave Clark 5 made, Catch Us If You Can?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you would expect that everybody, in wanting to replicate the success of A Hard Day's Night, which was a phenomenal film that we still talk about 50 years later, do something a little bit more like that. But instead, it's a much more dry drama type of a film.
Well, I wonder if Dave Clark, who was basically their manager, he ran the whole show there. He's a business guy.
Yes, Clark. He is.
You know, I wonder if he had, you know, I mean, he was an original thinker. You know, he was a guy who basically owned the tapes. He paid for the session time and leased the tapes to the record company.
Yes.
You know, as a young guy, right?
Right.
You know, in 1963. So maybe it was Dave Clark behind that saying, let's do something a bit different.
Yeah, I'm not sure the details of that, but it's a much different animal. It does not in the least try to copy A Hard Day's Night. And I'm thinking if Pete Best had stayed in the Beatles, maybe they would have done something more like that,
right,
to lesser results. Although, you know, it was on Turner in the last year or so, and I was watching it thinking, God, this has got like a homoerotic undercurrent to it.
Really?
I mean, it's like these guys are all athletic. You know, you've seen them do physical workout type stuff that you would never in a million years see the Beatles do. Because
oh, well, maybe Dave Clark really did have a hand in it then.
At least a hand, possibly more. But yeah, so just in speculating what a film with Pete Best and the Beatles would look like, I would think it'd be more akin to that than A Hard Day's Night, for sure. Even the silly stuff that Hermits did, you could at least see it sort of like a third-rate Dick Lester.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to mention that, and I thought, I remember seeing, you know, the Herman's Hermits one.
Hold on. Was it Hold On the first one, or Mrs. Brown?
Maybe Mrs. Brown. That's the one I'm thinking of, I think, is Mrs. Brown.
Is that the space one? Are they going to space?
It's one where it's basically they've gone Hollywood. It's a Hollywood setting with these guys. And, you know, and I've got to tell you, to be honest with you, to hear an American guy going, Herman, all the way through the film, Herman, instead of Herman, you know, it was just like, whoa, I don't know if I can deal with this.
Yeah, well, he was the second most popular Herman of the 60s in
America.
Yeah, there
you go. But we digress.
Herman Munster. Okay. So let's talk a bit about Tony Sheridan.
Yeah.
You know, here's a guy that I don't really feel may have gotten his due in terms of being another key player at the key moment in the Beatles' career, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, he was a little bit younger than John was. He was born in 41.
Yeah.
So right between John and Paul in terms of age, but more accomplished early on because
he'd already been on TV in the UK.
Yeah, he'd been on TV, he'd been on tour. You know, he was already had a residency in Hamburg.
And he's clearly an accomplished guitarist.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, they clearly were attracted to each other as musicians and as personalities. They really bonded extremely well.
Yeah.
And the story has always been that he sort of mentored George on guitar because he was quite an accomplished lead guitarist.
Well, yeah, for people who don't know out there, when you listen to My Bonnie, George is playing lead until we get to the solo.
Right.
And then the solo is, you know, Sheridan takes over there. And you can hear he really rips through it.
He does. And George just does those little fills.
Yeah.
You know, punctuating between the vocals.
Yes.
But, and that was Sheridan's influence as a guitar player, you know, showing George, you know, what's what, as well as, I guess, he influenced them about show business and stagemanship and all that kind of thing.
And, of course, he also took the bait from Lennon to deal with Pete.
Deal with Pete, yes. Yes, which again, in Tune In, Mark Lewison writes so colorfully about, where it was pretty well known that that Tony was very vocal and critical of Pete's shortcomings as a drummer.
Yeah.
You know, being a professional and having certain expectations.
Yeah, didn't have any patience for it.
And apparently, for a guy that's been depicted as kind of colorless and not much of a personality, I guess what he was known for was talking about his fighting abilities.
Well, don't forget, his judo. Dad was also a boxing promoter.
Yes, he was. Yeah. Johnny Best, was that his name?
Yep.
Yeah. So he's talking about his judo capabilities, kind of like precursing Elvis in the martial arts stuff. But finally, Lennon baits Sheridan into having a fist fight with Pete Best.
That's so great, though. Yeah, it's so Lennonish, that story. You know, it's Lennon always goading someone and setting things up. You know, trying to get people at each other. Yeah.
How has such a colorful vignette not yet been filmed in any of these, like Birth of the Beatles or Backbeat? I mean, it's such a great story.
Right.
But
well, maybe because, you know, Pete was what was he, technical advisor on one of them, right?
Yeah, right. Birth of the Beatles.
Yeah, maybe. I think the best he's given it is that he thinks that the fight came out a draw.
Right.
So and the fact that he says it was a draw most likely
means he lost. Well, Tony Sheridan, I guess, conceded that the following day they were both sore and could hardly move.
Yeah.
But it would have been quite something to witness.
Mm-hmm.
But they'd lay down rules: no kicks to the bollocks.
Right.
Had to be a fair fist fight.
Yeah. Now Sheridan, of course, interesting character because, as I said, he was a credible musician. He stayed in Hamburg, didn't he? He ended up living there.
And that's the thing, you know. You think about the what ifs, and here's a guy that got along well with the Beatles. They looked up to him. They admired his musicianship. You know, why didn't they have more of a relationship? They recorded together, for God's sake. The fact was that musically they were like two different animals. You know, him being a lot more blues based, R&B, that was really his thing.
Yeah.
And the Beatles, you know, had the sensibility that encompassed everything under the sun, practically. You know, as they're filling up those mighty stints, they're doing tunes and pop standards. And,
right. It's kind of sad, though, because, you know, again, you sort of think of him as a really credible musician.
Yeah.
And yet there he is by, was it, 64, re-recording the lyrics to Sweet Georgia Brown to put in a Beatle reference.
Yeah.
You
know, and it's like, as that ship is sailing away from him.
Yeah.
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 And it is a little bit sad.
It is.
We have a clip here. This was him, you know, again, in Hamburg, where he maintained his fan base. Performing on a Hamburg TV show. This is 1966, the year the Beatles are crafting Revolver. This is Tony Sheridan. I'll play a bit of this.
1, 2, 3, 4, shake it some more, all right. 5, 6, 7, 8, don't you be late, all right. 1, 2, 3, 4, shake it some more. 5, 6, 7,
so not to diss Tony Sheridan or his artistic sensibility, but you really see how he's a guy that, alongside the Beatles, wasn't really evolving. He was really rooted in that 60s rootsy, bluesy sound, and he couldn't move himself beyond that.
And in that way, it would have suited him to stay in Europe as opposed to the UK, you know, where I suppose you could still do that and still get yourself on TV.
Yes. Yeah, which he was able to do.
This rock music.
Authentic. it's too bad he didn't cross paths with the Stones, who he would have been a lot more, you know, the same sort of musical roots.
Mm.
But he was a performer. You know, I wonder what he could have done with them and if they would have taken any influence from him as somebody. But they were kind of, I think, hardcore more.
Right.
You know, he had to be black to
get
the time of day.
Yeah,
from him,
I think he was more, as you said, rooted in that sort of 50s rock and roll. He was more a rock and roller.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But interesting guy. And it's too bad because I would have loved to have had him on the show.
Yeah.
He's not with us anymore. There's always Pete Best. Pete Best did continue to make music, of course, such as it was. You know, they built the...
I'm going to knock on your door.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Well, Eddie, who did that originally? Eddie somebody. I was going to say Eddie Clayton, but that's not right. Eddie Hodges. Yes.
That's it. That's the guy.
But this is the thing. People have this perception, because there was that album floating around there on Savage Records, Best of the Beatles.
Yes.
You know, they really tried to capitalize on his persona. You know, he was in American TV in 64, and I've Got a Secret.
Right.
You know, he completely disingenuously explaining away why he wasn't a Beatle anymore. Yeah. But
have you seen that piece of film also where he's with Mona, his mum?
Yes.
And my God, you see it all there, don't you?
Oh,
she's like totally dominating.
Yeah, like a kicked puppy.
Yeah.
You look for it on YouTube, folks. I don't really feel like plugging it into the show right now. But it's very interesting that it even exists. And I'm not even sure what the context was for this.
Right.
Yeah, it just a little lament. But, you know, I think it's worth pointing out, as I did in Fab Four FAQ, there was a relationship, and I'm not even talking about Neil Aspinall, going on from a distance between the Best family and the Beatles ongoing.
Yeah.
Because you have the Sgt. Pepper shoot.
Yes.
And John borrows Mona Best's father's war medals to wear on his Pepper suit.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean...
And there's also that little ornament that Mona Best had given, isn't it? Down in the sort of shrubbery.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I'm not aware of that. What is it?
I can't remember, but I'm pretty sure it was an ornament that was, you know, given to Neil or something by Mona.
Daddy.
I mean, that's just a whole other aspect of the Beatles story, you know?
Yeah,
it just takes it off in a whole other weird direction.
It is interesting, you know, he ended up on Decca. Yeah, like they thought there was some residual value having passed on the Beatles to sign at least one Beatle.
Well, you see, that's what they spotted during the audition, that he was the guy they really wanted.
Once he lost those other three losers. they really were trying to keep him sort of on par. You know, there was that Best of the Beatles disingenuous album package.
Yeah.
I know the summer of 65, there was like a Capitol Starline, the old spinoff subsidiary label issue of Boys, with Kansas City on the flip.
Right.
And the label that Pete Best was assigned to in America put out those same two tunes with the Pete Best combo.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Like as if they were going to compete head to head.
Yeah.
Of course, I don't think the Beatle one even charted, but it doesn't matter. There was this last gasp of sort of trying to push him as an artist that went into 65 before it all faded away. I'll play a little bit here of a song that was actually issued called Pete's Theme. You know, there was
Right. Really, like Ringo's.
Exactly,
theme.
Right?
Oh my God, I didn't know about this.
No, listen to this. Check this out. Yes.
Well, what's he doing? Banging the tambourine on there?
Yeah, he's doing that while Andy White's on the kit. No, honestly, I don't know what he's doing. This is the misperception people have, though, is that Pete Best actually sang in the Pete Best band,
right?
Pete Best combo.
Right.
I've tried to research this, and the best, no pun intended, that I found is that there was some song they did, and I forget the title right now, that he did sort of a second kind of passing backing vocal.
Yeah.
But we know that he sang with the Beatles. He sang Boys, right?
Yeah.
He did Peppermint Twist.
But one second. Well, he did not Peppermint. Pinwheel Twist.
There's back and forth on that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I researched this. That was apparently a real song, a Lennon McCartney song, Pinwheel Twist.
Yeah.
Like a knockoff thing.
Right.
But depending on who's doing the telling, one of those songs they did, he was at the front of the stage, and Paul's on the drum kit, and there's pictures of this.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
But it's like, I can't even imagine what that would have sounded like.
Well, one sec, did he not sing then on I'm Gonna Knock on Your Door?
No.
Oh.
It was always these other guys that were, you know, these sort of satellites around Pete Best, the star. Right. It was kind of like a Dave Clark situation, really.
Right, right, right.
You know, Dave Clark didn't sing either.
Well, he did it later on.
In 68 he did. Yeah, something. Not very well.
The Red Balloon.
Yes. Very good. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, when you have Mike Smith in the band, who the hell needs Dave Clark to sing?
But we digress.
We digress. All these people safely dead we're talking about? Okay.
But it's just amazing, really, with Pete that, you know, the story kind of faded away by late 60s. I don't know if he went underground, but I remember being in Liverpool for one of their Magical History tours.
You're talking in the 70s.
In the late 70s, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. And I remember being on a tour bus with Alan Williams, of all people, as a tour guide. And someone saying, you know, what's happened to Pete Best? He said, well, I don't know. And someone said, well, wasn't he a baker the last that we heard? And he said, yes, well, you know, maybe that's code for bread, that he's been paid off. He's made a lot of money.
Alan Williams said that?
Yeah. And I remember sitting there thinking, really? Are you really going with this?
Paid
you
know, off that, for what?
But it's like no one seemed to know. There they are in Liverpool. They know where he lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like no one seemed to know what the story was.
So you didn't go to the Casbah or Heyman's Green at that
point? Yeah, went to Heyman's Green. And if you were to read Beatles 101, the Need to Know Guide, in there, there's my photo of Mona Best in the backyard, or as we call it in England, the garden, of Heyman's Green, where she met the fans. She was actually talking with the fans. Alan Williams went hiding because he'd described her in his book as that mean and volatile woman.
Mm.
And she was feeling mean and volatile about him. That's so he apparently was like hiding in a bush while we were all kind of meeting.
Did you get a picture of that?
No. Oh, man. I didn't get. But I got a picture of Mona and yeah, she was actually perfectly nice. But I do remember her saying, talking about, you know, people say, well, what do you feel about the other Beatles? Oh, if I catch up with those, you know, little rascals, I'll deal with them type thing.
Mona said that?
Yeah.
In the 70s?
Absolutely. In like about 1978.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did John ever give the medals back? That's what she's talking about.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was, You know, it was a weird.
That was your brush with greatness.
Oh, absolutely. Mm. But you know, but it's a weird thing because that story was never really fully told. And by the time that Pete told his story, you just have a feeling that he's kind of, you know, glossed things over and try to make it sound like he was just one of the lads.
Yes.
Yeah. So what do you reckon? Do you think Mona was a Mona?
We'd have to ask Neil about that.
Yeah, there you go. Mm. All right. On that.
Be sure to tune in for more colorful anecdotes from the life of Richard Buskin on Something About the Beatles. So to circle back and tie together Tony Sheridan, Pete Best, The Beatles, 1969, Fantasize No More, Richard, I have here actual audio. Those two playing together, Pete Best playing Come Together. For real.
Really?
Yes.
With Tony Sheridan.
With Tony Sheridan.
And this isn't fake.
This isn't fake. This is in Paris.
My God, my dream realized.
Yes. This is in 2008, I think.
Oh.
Yeah, wait for it. Here we go.
Unbelievable. What can I say? Absolutely unbelievable.
The visual exists. If somebody just told me, yeah, this is Tony Sheridan with Pete Best, I'd be like, yeah.
In some ways, I'd rather just have the visual in my mind.
Yeah, I think somebody needed to wake him up to let him know what they were playing at that point, but he just kind of plods through it. You know, at least he's not doing the 16th note fills on it.
That's right.
We heard earlier.
Yeah.
But no, this is for real, folks. And you know, we don't offer this to demean him, diminish his skill set. I mean, who among us, not knowing that song would come up during the set, would have handled themselves better? I don't know. But there it is. So God love you, Pete.
And meanwhile,
rest in peace, Tony.
We've got one more sort of bit of fantasy, haven't we, to end the show?
Yeah, let's end it on a higher note, shall we?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
So I just want to say thanks for listening. This is Richard Buskin.
This is Robert Rodriguez.
And this has been
Something About the Beatles.
Thomas Rapetney. Executive producer, Rick Way. Title song recorded by the Corgis.